Our industrialized food system feeds billions of people. It depends on oil and gas for fertilizers, tractor fuel, truck and ship distribution, pesticides. The list of oil inputs to our food supply is almost endless. But world supplies of oil and gas are running down. After peak oil, how will we feed the planet? That is addressed by a longtime peak oil advocate, author Richard Heinberg, in this Lady Eve Balfour Memorial Lecture in London, UK, on November 22, 2007. The speech to the British Soil Association is What Will We Eat When the Oil Runs Out? Richard is introduced by Anna Ford of the BBC in this remastered version of an essential message for human planning.
And welcome. It's wonderful to see so many familiar faces and such a very good turnout for a lecture of this nature. The battle is raging, isn't it? And more people are getting involved. And I think that's an incredibly exciting thing that's happening. But Richard has, I know, some statistics for us tonight that even we will find more disturbing than the statistics we've heard before. My name's Anna Ford. The Soil Association have asked me tonight to chair this memorial Lady Eve Balfour lecture, and I'm very pleased to do so. Partly because how pleased she would have been to have been here tonight and to have seen how far her movement has got. Her vision and her foresight 61 years ago, when she set up an organisation not very far from here, just down the road, led to this extraordinary organisation called the Soil Association, which of course promotes all these marvellous things and is now the greatest champion of organic food and of farming. But it also led to a far greater public understanding of that very important thing, the relationship between the soil, food and health, and the fact that without soil, she knew, there is no life for any of us. And the Soil Association since those days has been a pioneer organisation from the very start, and it is responsible for the development of the world's first organic standards, the development of organic farming, which is now approaching 5% of the United Kingdom's farming land area, the development of the whole market for organic foods, now worth almost £2 billion, campaigning against the damaging consequences of industrial agriculture with respect to pesticides, antibiotics, animal protein in animal feed, animal diseases, and of course GM, and playing a major role in improving the quality and sourcing of school meals as part of a joint partnership Food for Life program. All those important things done by the Soil Association. But I know, looking at you, that I'm preaching to the converted. But the theme of tonight's lecture, and it's becoming clearer by the day that the world is confronted by twin threats, the threat of climate change and the threat of fossil fuel depletion. I was asked to join the board of Sainsbury's, and there may be a big hiss here, and I would quite understand if there were, about 18 months ago, but I thought, well, either I can stand outside the door of Sainsbury's and campaign, or I can join this organisation which sells 18% of the food that is bought in this country, and try and have a say. And in fact, I now chair the board committee on CR. And we have had a large number of dinners recently where we have discussed all sorts of matters to do with the production of food. So even some of the supermarkets are really getting involved in this. But we need very urgent action now to develop more sustainable food and farming systems because of the legacy of a whole century of industrialization and exploitation that our children will inherit and which may pose a threat to their very survival. Tonight's speaker, Richard Heinberg, is a polymath. He's an educator, an editor, a lecturer, a core faculty member of New College, California, where he teaches a program on culture, ecology, and sustainable community, and a research fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute. He has emerged, arguably, as the world's leading expert on fossil fuel depletion and agriculture, and having heard him speak at the Soil Association's annual conference, in January this year, I know that he has a vitally important message to bring to us tonight. His publications on the theme of Power Down, the Oil Depletion Protocols, and his latest book, published only last week, which is entitled Peak Everything, really do give us food for thought. Richard, if he weren't here in this particular capacity tonight, might be off playing the violin, because he is a classical violinist, and he could have had a career in music. And I know that when he's not being anxious about all these things that threaten us today, his greatest love, when it's not gardening, is to play his violin and to release his mind for a moment or two from those anxieties. We are nearing the end of what is now referred to as the fossil fuel era. And it's very difficult to convince people that this is, the peak oil years are possibly over, and that we face a world without the oil that we have become used to. And Richard's title of his talk tonight, What Will We Eat When the Oil Runs Out, is very apposite. He believes that the provision of food as the most basic of all human needs is the single most important element of the preparation. And I'm delighted to welcome him to present this year's Lady Eve Balfour Memorial Lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome Richard Heinberg.
Thank you very much for that warm welcome and introduction, and my deep thanks to Patrick Holden and the Soil Association for the privilege and honor of the invitation to deliver tonight's talk. The subject is a very challenging one. Our global food system faces a crisis of unprecedented scope. This crisis, which threatens to imperil the lives of hundreds of millions, possibly even billions of human beings, consists of four simultaneously colliding dilemmas, all arising from our relatively recent pattern of dependence on depleting fossil fuels. The first dilemma consists of the direct impacts on agriculture of higher oil prices, increased costs of fuel for tractors, agricultural chemicals, and the transport of farm inputs and outputs. The second dilemma is an indirect consequence of high oil prices, and that is the increased demand for biofuels. And that demand is resulting in farmland being turned from food production to fuel production, thus making food more costly. The third dilemma consists of the impacts of climate change and extreme weather events caused by fuel-based greenhouse gas emissions. Climate change is really the central issue of our time. However, fossil fuel depletion complicates the situation enormously, and if we fail to address both of these problems at once, we will probably fail with both. Finally comes the degradation or loss of basic natural resources, principally topsoil and fresh water, as a result of high rates and unsustainable methods of production stimulated by decades of cheap energy. Each of these problems is developing at a somewhat different pace regionally, and each is exacerbated by the continually expanding size of the human population. As these dilemmas collide, the resulting overall food crisis is likely to be, as I mentioned earlier, profound and unprecedented in scope. So I propose to discuss each of these dilemmas briefly and to show how all are intertwined with our societal reliance on oil and other fossil fuels. I'll then argue that the primary solution to the overall crisis of the world food system must be a planned, rapid reduction in the use of fossil fuels in the growing and delivery of food. As we'll see, this strategy, though ultimately unavoidable, will bring enormous problems of its own, unless it's applied with forethought and intelligence. But the organic movement is uniquely positioned to guide this inevitable transition of the world's food systems away from reliance on fossil fuels if leaders and practitioners of the various strands of organic agriculture are willing to work together and with policymakers. Until now, fossil fuels have been widely perceived as an enormous boon to humanity and certainly to the human food system. After all, there was a time not so long ago when famine was an expected, if not accepted, part of life, even in wealthy countries. Until the 19th century, whether in China, France, India, or Britain, food came almost entirely from local sources, and harvests were variable. In good years, there was plenty, enough for seasonal feasts and for storage in anticipation of winter and hard times to come. In bad years, starvation cut down the poor, the very young, the old, and the sickly. Sometimes bad years followed one upon another, reducing the size of the population by several percent. This was the normal condition of life in pre-industrial societies, and it persisted for thousands of years. By the 19th century, a profound shift in this ancient regime was underway. For Europeans, the export of surplus population to other continents, crop rotation, and the application of manures and composts were all gradually making famines less frequent and severe. European farmers, realizing the need for a new nitrogen source in order to continue feeding burgeoning and increasingly urbanized populations, began employing guano, imported from islands off the coasts of Chile and Peru. The results were gratifying. However, after only a few decades, these guano deposits were being depleted. By this time, in the late 1890s, the world's population was nearly twice what it had been at the beginning of the century. A crisis was in view. But crisis was narrowly averted through the use of fossil fuels. In 1909, two German chemists named Fritz Haber and Karl Bosch invented a process to synthesize ammonia from atmospheric nitrogen and the hydrogen in fossil fuels. Today, that process yields 150 million tons of ammonia-based fertilizer per year, producing a total quantity of available nitrogen equal to the amount introduced annually by all natural sources combined. Fossil fuels went on to offer other ways of extending natural limits to the human carrying capacity of the planet. In the 1890s, roughly one quarter of British and American cropland had been set aside to grow grain to feed horses, of which most worked on farms. The internal combustion engine provided a new kind of horsepower, not dependent on horses at all, and thereby increased the amount of arable land available to feed humans. Chemists developed synthetic pesticides and herbicides in increasing varieties after World War II, using knowledge pioneered in laboratories that had worked to perfect explosives and other chemical warfare agents. Petrochemical-based pesticides not only increased crop yields in North America, Europe, and Australia, but also reduced the prevalence of insect-borne diseases like malaria. The world began to enjoy the benefits of better living through chemistry, though the environmental costs in terms of water and soil pollution and damage to vulnerable species would only later become widely apparent. In the 1960s, industrial chemical agriculture practices began to be exported to what by that time was being called the Third World. This was glowingly dubbed the Green Revolution, and it enabled a tripling of food production during the ensuing half century. At the same time, the scale and speed of distribution of food increased. This also constituted a means of increasing human carrying capacity, though in a more subtle way. Here again, fossil fuels were responsible for a dramatic discontinuity in the previous slow pace of growth. First by rail and steamship, then by truck and airplane, immense amounts of grain and ever larger quantities of meat, vegetables, and specialty foods began to flow from countryside to city, from region to region, and from continent to continent. The end result of chemical fertilizers plus powered farm machinery plus increased scope of transportation and trade was not just an enormous leap in crop yields, but a similar explosion of the human population, which has grown over sixfold since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. However, in the process, conventional industrial agriculture has become overwhelmingly dependent on fossil fuels. According to one study, approximately 10 calories of fossil fuel energy are needed to produce each calorie of food energy in modern agriculture. With globalized trade in food, many regions host human populations larger than local resources alone could possibly support. Those systems of global distribution and trade, of course, also rely on oil. Today, in the industrialized world, the frequency of famine that our ancestors knew and expected, it's hard to imagine. Food is so cheap and plentiful that obesity is a far more widespread concern than hunger. The average mega supermarket stocks an impressive array of exotic foods from across the globe, and even staples are typically trucked or shipped from hundreds of miles away. All of this would be well and good if it were sustainable. But the fact that nearly all of this recent abundance depends on depleting, non-renewable fossil fuels whose burning emits climate-altering carbon dioxide gas means that the current situation is not sustainable. And that, in turn, means that it must and will come to an end. During the past decade, a growing chorus of energy analysts has warned of the approach of peak oil, the time when the global rate of extraction of petroleum will reach a maximum and begin its inevitable decline. During this same decade, the price of oil has advanced from about $12 per barrel to nearly $100 per barrel. While there is some dispute among experts as to when the peak will occur, there are the near peakers and the far peakers. There is none as to whether it will occur. The global peak is merely the cumulative result of production peaks in individual oil fields and whole oil-producing countries. And these mini peaks are occurring at an increasing rate. The most famous and instructive national peak occurred in the U.S. in 1970. At that time, America produced 9.5 million barrels of oil per day. The current figure is less than 5 million barrels per day. While at one time the U.S. produced fully half the world's oil supply, today it's the world's foremost importer. The history of U.S. oil production also helps us evaluate the prospects for delaying the global peak. After 1970, exploration efforts succeeded in identifying two enormous new American oil provinces, the North Slope of Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. During this period, other kinds of liquid fuels, such as ethanol and gas condensates, began to supplement crude. Also, improvements in oil recovery technology helped to increase the proportion of oil extractable from existing fields. These are precisely the strategies, exploration, substitution, and technological improvements, that oil producers are relying on to delay the global production peak. In the U.S., each of these strategies made a difference, but not enough of one to reverse for more than a year or two at a time the overall 37-year trend of declining production. To assume that the results for the world as a whole will be much different is probably unwise. The recent peak in decline in production of oil from the North Sea is perhaps of more direct relevance to this audience. In just 7 years, production from the British-controlled region has declined by almost half. How near is the global peak? Well, today the majority of oil-producing nations are seeing reduced output. In 2006, BP's Statistical Review of World Energy reported that in 27 out of 51 producing nations listed, there were declines. In some instances, these declines will be temporary and can be turned around by new investment in production or exploration. But in most instances, the decline results from factors of geology. While older oil fields continue to yield crude, Beyond a certain point, it becomes impossible to maintain existing flow rates by any available means. As a result, over time, there are fewer nations in the category of oil exporters and more nations in the category of oil importers. Meanwhile, global rates of discovery of new oil fields have been declining since 1964. These two trends, a growing preponderance of past peak producing nations and a declining success rate for exploration, by themselves suggest that the world peak may be near. Clearly, the timing of the global peak is crucial. If it happens soon, or if in fact it has already occurred, the consequences will be devastating. Oil has become the world's foremost energy resource. There is no ready substitute. And decades will be required to wean societies from it. Peak oil could therefore constitute the greatest economic challenge since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. An authoritative new study by the Energy Watch Group of Germany concludes that global crude production hit its maximum level in 2006 and has already begun its gradual decline. Indeed, the past 2 years have seen sustained high prices for oil, a situation that should provide every incentive to increase production wherever possible. Yet actual aggregate production of conventional petroleum has stagnated during this period. The record monthly total for crude production was achieved in May 2005, 30 months ago. The latest medium-term report of the IEA, International Energy Agency, issued July 9, projects that world oil demand will rise about 2.2% per year until 2012, while production will lag, resulting in what the report's authors call a supply crunch. Many put their hopes in coal and other low-grade fossil fuels to substitute for depleting oil. However, global coal production will hit its own peak, perhaps as soon as 10 to 15 years from now, according to the most recent studies, while so-called clean coal technologies, carbon capture and storage, are probably 3 decades away from widespread commercial application. Thus, to avert a climate catastrophe from coal carbon emissions, our best hope and strategy is simply to keep most of the remaining coal in the ground. During these past 2 years, as oil prices have soared, food prices have done so as well. Farmers now face steeply increasing costs for tractor fuel, agricultural chemicals, and transport of farm inputs and outputs. However, the linkage between fuel and food prices is more complicated than this, and there are other factors entirely separate from petroleum costs that have impacted food prices. First, it's worth taking a moment to survey the price statistics on their own. An article by John Vidal published in The Guardian on November 3rd titled "Global Food Crisis Looms as Climate Change and Fuel Shortages Bite" began this way, and I quote, "Empty shelves in Caracas, food riots in West Bengal and Mexico, warnings of hunger in Jamaica, Nepal, and the Philippines and sub-Saharan Africa. Soaring prices for basic foods are beginning to lead to political instability, with governments being forced to step in to artificially control the cost of bread, maize, rice, and dairy products. Record world prices for most staple foods have led to 18% food price inflation in China, 13% in Indonesia and Pakistan, and 10% or more in Latin America, Russia, and in India. Wheat has doubled in price, maize is nearly 50% higher than a year ago, and rice is 20% more expensive. Last week, the Kremlin forced Russian companies to freeze the price of milk, bread, and other foods. India, Yemen, Mexico, and Burkina Faso, and several other countries have had or been close to food riots in the last year. Meanwhile, there are shortages of beef, chicken, and milk in Venezuela and other countries as governments try to keep a lid on food price inflation," end of quote. Jacques Diouf, head of the FAO, said in London early this month, "If you combine the increase of oil prices and the increase of food prices, then you have the elements of a very serious crisis." And indeed, FAO statistics show that grain stocks have been declining for more than a decade and now stand at a mere 57 days, the lowest level in a quarter century. According to Josette Sheeran, director of the UN's World Food Program, quote, there are 854 million hungry people in the world, and 4 million more join their ranks every year. We are facing the tightest food supplies in recent history. Meanwhile, a story by Peter Apps in Reuters from October 16 noted that the cost of food aid is rising dramatically, just as the global need for aid is expanding. The amount of money that nations and international agencies set aside for food aid remains relatively constant, while the amount of food that that money will buy is shrinking. To be sure, higher food prices are good for farmers. Assuming that at least some of the increase in price actually translates to higher income for growers, this is indeed the case for the poorest farmers who have never adopted industrial methods. But for many others, the higher prices paid for food simply reflect higher production costs. Meanwhile, it's the urban poor who are impacted the worst. One factor influencing food prices comes from the growing incentives for farmers worldwide to produce biofuel crops rather than food crops. Ethanol and biodiesel can be produced from a variety of crops, including maize, soy, rapeseed, sunflower, cassava, sugarcane, palm, and jatropha. As the price of oil rises, many farmers are finding that they can produce more farm income from their efforts by growing these crops and selling them to a biofuels plant than by growing food crops either for local community or for export. Already nearly 20% of the U.S. maize crop is devoted to making ethanol, and that proportion is expected to rise at least to one quarter based solely on existing projects in development and government mandates. The U.S. is responsible for 70% of world maize exports, and countries such as Mexico, Japan, and Egypt that depend on American corn farmers use maize as both as food for people and feed for animals. The ballooning of the U.S. ethanol industry is therefore impacting food availability in other nations both directly and indirectly, raising the price for tortillas in Mexico and disrupting the livestock and poultry industries in Europe and Africa. Grain, a Barcelona-based food resources NGO, reports that the Indian government is committed to planting 14 million hectares with jatropha for biodiesel production. Meanwhile, Brazil plans to grow 120 million hectares of fuel crops, and Africa up to 400 million hectares. While currently unproductive land will be used for much of this new production, many millions of people will be forced off that land in the process. Lester Brown, founder of the Washington-based Earth Policy Institute, has said, quote, the competition for grain between the world's 800 million motorists who want to maintain their mobility, and its 2 billion poorest people who are simply trying to survive, is emerging as an epic issue. This is an opinion no longer being voiced just by environmentalists. In its twice-yearly report on the world economy released October 17, the International Monetary Fund noted that, quote, the use of food as a source of fuel may have serious implications for the demand for food if the expansion of biofuels continues. And earlier this month, Oxfam warned the EU that its policy of substituting 10% of all auto fuel with biofuels threatened to displace poor farmers. Jean Ziegler, a UN special rapporteur, went so far as to call the biofuels trade, quote, a crime against humanity, and echoed journalist George Monbiot's call for a 5-year moratorium on government mandates and incentives for biofuel expansion. The British government has pledged that only the most sustainable biofuels will be used in the UK. But as Monbiot has recently noted, there are no explicit standards to define sustainable biofuels, and there are no means to enforce those standards in any case. Beyond the push for biofuels, the food crisis is also being driven by extreme weather events and environmental degradation. The phrase global warming implies only the fact that the world's average temperature will increase by a degree or more over the next few decades. The much greater problem for farmers is destabilization of weather patterns. We face not just a warmer climate, but climate chaos, droughts, floods, and stronger storms in general. In short, unpredictable weather of all kinds. Farmers depend on relatively consistent seasonal patterns of rain and sun, cold and heat. A climate shift can spell the end of farmers' ability to grow a crop in a given region, and even a single freak storm can destroy an entire year's national production for some crops. Given the fact that modern agriculture has become highly centralized due to cheap transport and economies of scale, the damage from that freak storm is today potentially continental or even global in scale. According to the UN's World Food Program, 57 countries, including 29 in Africa, 19 in Asia, and 9 in Latin America, have been hit by catastrophic floods. Harvests have been affected by drought and heat waves in South Asia, Europe, China, Sudan, Mozambique, and Uruguay. Last week, the Australian government said drought had slashed predictions of winter harvests by nearly 40%, or 4 million tons. In addition to climate chaos, we must contend with the depletion or degradation of several important resources. Phosphorus is set to become much more scarce and expensive, according to a study by Patrick Deary, a Canadian agriculture and environment analyst and consultant. Using data from the U.S. Geological Survey, Deary performed a peaking analysis on phosphate rock, similar to the techniques used by petroleum geologists to forecast declines in production from oil fields. He found that, quote, "we have already passed the phosphate peak of production for the United States and for the world." Well, we won't completely run out of rock phosphate anytime soon, any more than we'll completely run out of oil. But we will be relying on lower-grade ores as time goes on, with prices inexorably rising. At the same time, soil erosion undermines food production and water availability, as well as producing 30% of climate-changing greenhouse gases. Each year, roughly 100,000 square kilometers of land loses its vegetation and becomes degraded or turns into desert, altering the temperature and energy balance of the planet. Finally, yet another worrisome environmental trend is the increasing scarcity of fresh water. According to the UN, 1/3 of the world's population lives in areas with water shortages, and 1.1 billion people lack access to safe drinking water. That situation is expected to worsen dramatically over the next few decades. Climate change has provoked more frequent and intense droughts in subtropical areas of Asia and Africa, exacerbating shortages in some of the world's poorest countries. While human population tripled in the 20th century, the use of renewable water resources has grown sixfold. According to Bridget Scanlon and her colleagues writing in Water Resources Research this past March 27th, in the last 100 years, irrigated agriculture expanded globally by 480%, and it is expected to increase another 20% by 2030. Irrigation is expanding fastest in countries such as China and India. Global irrigated agriculture now accounts for almost 90% of global freshwater consumption. These problems all interact and compound one another. For example, soil degradation produces growing shortages of water, since soil and vegetation act as a sponge that holds and gradually releases water. Soil degradation also worsens climate change, as increased evaporation triggers more extreme weather. This month, the UN Environment Program concluded that the planet's water, land, air, plants, and animals, and fish stocks are all in, quote, inexorable decline. Much of this decline is due to agriculture, which constitutes the greatest single source of human impact on the biosphere. In the face of all these daunting challenges, the world must produce more food every year to keep up with population growth. Zafar Adil, director of the International Network of Water, Environment, and Health, has calculated that more food will have to be produced during the next 50 years than during the last 10,000 years combined. Well, what's the solution? International food agency officials spin out various scenarios to describe how our currently precarious global food system might successfully adapt and expand. Perhaps markets will automatically readjust to shortages, higher prices making it more profitable once again to grow crops for people rather than cars. New designer gene crop varieties could help crops adapt to capricious climatic conditions, to require less water, or to grow in more marginal soils. And if people were simply to eat less meat, more land could be freed up to grow food for humans rather than farm animals. A slowdown or reversal in population growth would naturally ease pressures on the food system, while the cultivation of currently unproductive land could help increase supplies also. However, given the scale of the crisis facing us, merely to assume that these things will happen, or that they will be sufficient to overcome the dilemmas we've been discussing, seems overly optimistic, perhaps even to the point of irresponsibility. One hopeful sign is that governments and international agencies are beginning to take the situation seriously. This month, the World Bank issued a major report, Agriculture for Development, whose main author, economist Alain de Genvry, appears to reverse his institution's traditional stance. For a half century, development agencies like the World Bank have minimized the importance of agriculture, urging nations to industrialize and urbanize as rapidly as possible. Indeed, the bank has not featured agriculture in an annual report since 1982. De Genvry says that since half the world's population and three-quarters of the world's poor live in rural areas where food production is the mainstay of the economy, farming must be central to efforts to reduce hunger and poverty. Really. Many agencies are now calling for an end to the estimated $30 billion in food subsidies in the north that contribute directly to land degradation in Africa and elsewhere, and that force poor farmers to intensify their production in order to compete. In addition, there are calls for sweeping changes in how land use decisions are made at all levels of government. Delegates at a soils forum in Iceland this month took up a proposal for a formal agreement on protecting the world's soils, and the World Water Council is promoting a range of programs to ensure the availability of clean water, especially to people in poorer countries. All these efforts are laudable, essential. However, they largely fail to address the common source of the dilemmas we face: human population growth and societies and agriculture's reliance on fossil fuels. The solution most often promoted by the biggest companies within the agriculture industry, the bioengineering of crops and farm animals, does little or nothing to address these deeper causes. One can fantasize about modifying maize or rice to fix nitrogen in the way legumes do, but so far efforts in that direction have failed. Meanwhile, the bioengineering industry itself consumes fossil fuels and assumes the continued availability of oil for tractors, transportation, chemicals production, and so on. To get to the heart of the crisis, we need a more fundamental reform of agriculture than anything we have seen in decades. In essence, we need an agriculture that does not require fossil fuels. The idea is not new. The aim of substantially or entirely removing fossil fuels from agriculture is implicit in organic farming in all its various forms and permutations, including ecological agriculture, biodynamic, permaculture, biointensive farming, and natural farming. All also have in common a prescription for the reduction or elimination of tillage, and the reduction or elimination of reliance on mechanized farm equipment. Nearly all of these systems rely on increased amounts of human labor and on greater application of place-specific knowledge of soils, microorganisms, weather, water, and the interactions between plants, animals, and humans. Critics of organic or biological agriculture have always contended that chemical-free and less mechanized forms of food production are incapable of feeding the burgeoning human population. This view is increasingly being challenged. A recent survey of studies by Christos Vasilikiotis of UC Berkeley, titled Can Organic Farming Feed the World, concluded, quote, from the studies mentioned above and from an increasing body of case studies, it is becoming evident that organic farming does not result in catastrophic crop losses due to pests nor in dramatically reduced yields. The most recent study on the subject in the journal Renewable Agriculture and Food Systems found that, quote, organic farming can yield up to 3 times as much food on individual farms in developing countries as conventional methods on the same land. End of quote. Moreover, it's becoming clear that ecological agriculture could help directly to address some of the dilemmas we've been discussing, such as water. Organic production can help by building soil structure, thus reducing the need for irrigation. And with no petrochemical runoff, water quality is not degraded. Soil erosion and land degradation can be halted and even reversed. By careful composting, organic farmers have demonstrated the ability to build humus at many times the natural rate. Climate change can be addressed by keeping carbon molecules in the soil and in forests and grasslands. As much as 20% of the anticipated net fossil fuel emissions between now and 2025 could be stored in this way. Natural gas depletion will mean higher prices and shortages for ammonia-based nitrogen fertilizers, but ecologically sound organic biological agriculture practices use plant and manure-based fertilizers rather than fossil fuels. And when farmers concentrate on building healthy topsoil rich in beneficial microbes, plants have reduced needs for nitrogen. The impending global shortage of phosphate will be more difficult to address, as there is no substitute for this substance. The only solution here will be to recycle nutrients by returning all animal and human manures to cultivated soils, as Asian farmers did for many centuries, and as many ecological farmers have long advocated. Well, how might we actually accomplish this comprehensive transformation of world agriculture? Some clues are offered by the example of a society that's already experienced and dealt with a fossil fuel famine. In the late 1980s, farmers in Cuba were highly reliant on cheap fuels and petrochemicals imported from the Soviet Union. In 1990, as the Soviet Empire collapsed, Cuba lost those imports and faced an agricultural crisis. The average Cuban lost 20 pounds of body weight. The Cuban GDP fell dramatically. Several agronomists at Cuban universities had for many years been advocating a transition to organic methods. Cuban authorities responded to the crisis by giving these ecological agronomists carte blanche to redesign the nation's food system. Officials broke up large state-owned farms, offered land to farming families, and encouraged the formation of small agricultural co-ops. Cuban farmers began employing oxen as a replacement for the tractors they could no longer afford to fuel. Cuban scientists began investigating biological methods of pest control and soil fertility enhancement. The government sponsored widespread education in organic food production, and the Cuban people adopted a mostly vegetarian diet out of necessity. Salaries for agricultural workers were raised, in many cases, to above the levels of urban office workers. Urban gardens were encouraged in parking lots and on public lands, and thousands of rooftop gardens appeared. As a result of these efforts, Cuba was able to avoid what might otherwise have been a severe famine. If the rest of the world does not plan for a reduction in fossil fuel use in agriculture, its post-peak oil agricultural transition may be far less successful than was Cuba's. Already in poor countries, farmers who are attempting to apply industrial methods but cannot afford tractor fuel and petrochemical inputs are watching their crops fail. Soon farmers in wealthier nations will be having a similar experience. Where food is still being produced, there will be the challenge of getting it to the stores. Britain had a taste of this problem in 2000. David Strawn relates in his brilliant book, The Last Oil Shock, how close Britain came to political chaos then as truckers went on strike because of high fuel costs. He writes, quote, supermarket shelves were being stripped of staple foods in scenes of panic buying. Sainsbury, Asda, and Safeway reported that some branches were having to ration bread and milk. This was, of course, merely a brief interruption in the normal functioning of the British energy food system. In the future, we may be facing instead what my colleague James Howard Kunstler calls the long emergency. How will Britain and the rest of the world cope? What will be needed to ensure a successful transition from an oil-based food system, as opposed to a haphazard and perhaps catastrophic reaction? Because ecological organic farming methods are often dramatically more labor and knowledge intensive, their adoption will require an economic transformation of societies. The transition to a non-fossil fuel food system will take time. Nearly every aspect of the process by which we feed ourselves will have to be redesigned. And given the likelihood that global oil peak will occur soon, this transition must occur at a forced pace, backed by the full resources of national governments. Without cheap transport fuels, we will have to reduce the amount of food transportation that occurs and make necessary transportation more efficient. This implies increased local food self-sufficiency. We will need to grow more food in and around cities. Recently, Oakland, California adopted a food policy that mandates that by 2015, 40% of the vegetables consumed within the city will be grown within a 50-mile radius. Localization of food systems means moving producers and consumers of food closer together, but it also means relying on the local manufacture and regeneration of all of the elements of the production process, from seeds to tools and machinery. This again would appear to rule out agricultural bioengineering, which favors the centralized production of patented seed varieties and discourages the free saving of seeds from year to year by farmers. Clearly, we must also minimize indirect chemical inputs to agriculture, such as those introduced in packaging and processing. We will need to reintroduce draft animals in agricultural production. Oxen may be preferable to horses in many instances because the former can eat straw and stubble, while the latter would compete with humans for grains. We can only bring back working animals to the extent that we can free up land with which to produce food for them. One way to do that would be to reduce the number of farm animals grown for meat. Governments must also provide incentives for people to return to an agricultural life. It would be a mistake to think of this simply in terms of the need for a larger agricultural workforce. Successful traditional agriculture requires social networks and intergenerational sharing of skills and knowledge. We need not just more agricultural workers, but a rural culture that makes farming a rewarding way of life, capable of attracting young people. Farming requires knowledge and experience, and so we will need education for a new generation of farmers. It will be necessary as well to break up the corporate mega farms that produce so much of today's cheap food. Industrial agriculture implies an economy of scale that will be utterly inappropriate and unworkable for post-industrial food systems. Thus, land reform will be required. In order for all of this to happen, governments must end subsidies to industrial agriculture and begin subsidizing post-industrial agricultural efforts. There are many ways this could be done. The present regime of subsidies is so harmful that merely stopping it in its tracks would be advantageous. But given the fact that rapid adaptation is essential, offering subsidies for education, no interest loans for land purchases, and technical support during the transition from chemical to organic production would be extremely helpful. Finally, given carrying capacity limits, food policy must include population policy. We must encourage smaller families by means of economic incentives and we must improve the economic and educational status of women in poorer countries. All of this constitutes a gargantuan task, but the alternative, doing nothing or attempting to solve our food production problems simply by applying more techno fixes, will almost certainly lead to dire consequences. All of the worrisome trends mentioned earlier would intensify to the point that the human carrying capacity of Earth would be degraded significantly and perhaps to a large degree permanently. So far, we've addressed the responsibility of government in facilitating the needed transformation in agriculture. Consumers can help enormously by becoming more conscious of their food choices, seeking out locally produced organic foods, and reducing meat consumption. The organic movement, while it may view this crisis in industrial agriculture as an opportunity, also bears an enormous responsibility. In the example of Cuba just cited, the active lobbying of organic agronomists proved crucial. Without that guiding effort on the part of previously marginalized experts, the authorities would have had no way to respond. Now, crisis is at hand for the whole world. The organic movement has most of the answers that will be needed. However, its message still isn't getting through. Three things will be needed to change that. First, the various strands of the organic movement must come together so that they can speak to national and international policymakers with a unified voice. Second, the leaders of this newly unified organic movement must produce a coherent plan for a global transition to a post-fossil fuel food system. Organic farmers and their organizations have been promoting some of the needed policies for decades in a piecemeal fashion. Now, however, there's an acute need for a clearly formulated, comprehensive, alternative national and global food policy. And there's little time to communicate and implement it. It's up to the organic movement to proactively seek out policymakers and promote this coherent alternative, just as it's up to representatives of government at all levels to listen. And third and finally, I've just called for unity in the organic movement, and to achieve this, it will be necessary to address a recent split within that movement. What might be called traditional organic remains focused on small-scale, labor-intensive, local production for local consumption. In contrast to this, the more recently emerging corporate model merely removes petrochemicals from production while maintaining nearly all the other characteristics of the modern industrial food system. This latter trend may be entirely understandable in terms of the economic pressures and incentives within the food industry as a whole. However, corporate organics has much less to offer in terms of solutions to the emerging crisis. Thus, as the various strands of the organic movement come together, they must do so in light of the larger societal necessity. The discussion must move beyond merely gaining market share. It must focus on averting famine under crisis conditions. To conclude, let me simply restate what I hope is clear by now. Given the fact that fossil fuels are limited in quantity and that we are already in view of the global oil production peak, we must turn to a food system that is less fuel reliant, even if the process is problematic in many ways. Of course, the transition that's required will take time. It's a process that must occur in stages. It's a journey that will take place over decades. Nevertheless, it must begin soon, and it must begin with a comprehensive plan. The transition to a fossil fuel-free food system does not constitute a distant utopian proposal. It is an unavoidable, immediate, and immense challenge that will call for unprecedented levels of creativity at all levels of society. 100 years from now, everyone will be eating what we today would define as organic food, whether or not we act. But what we do now will determine how many will be eating. What state of health will be enjoyed by these future generations, and whether they will live in a ruined cinder of a world or one that is in the process of being renewed and replenished. Thank you very much.
You have just heard author Richard Heinberg delivering the Lady Eve Balfour Memorial Lecture in London, UK, on November 22, 2007. The title was, What Will We Eat When the Oil Runs Out? The event was organized by the Soil Association in Britain. Find them at soilassociation.org. This version of the speech has been remastered from the original to remove recording flaws by Alex Smith of ecoshock.org. Richard Heinberg is the author of 8 books, including The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and Peak Everything. Find out more at richardheinberg.com.